I'm going to try and motivate this by talking about oceanographic and climate problems. So this is a picture of the Pacific from south to north as a function of latitude and depth. And what you can see, of course, as you might expect, is that the surface waters at lowish latitudes near the equator and spreading to some distance north and south are warm compared to the water below. And that's because the sun shines on the ocean surface. And one of the major questions is, how does the heat that's put in at the surface get mixed down into the interior of the ocean? And the basic feature that goes on in these systems is this meridional overturning. So essentially, as I said, the solar heating near the equator and cooling near the poles. So dense water is formed at the poles. It sinks and flows along the bottom towards the equator. And if heat was not mixed down, of course, it would just get would just fill up with cold water. And that's not what happens. So there's a process by which the heat that's put in at the surface gets mixed down into the interior. And we want to know how that happens. And as you can imagine, since the water at the surface is warm, it's buoyant. So you have to do work to push it down. And the work essentially comes from the wind. So that generates currents that provides turbulence that causes the mixing process. And so in climate models, that process needs to be accounted for. So this is a picture actually from NOAA's website showing a typical kind of grid for a climate model encompassing the atmosphere and the oceans. And it includes, of course, these physical processes in the ocean. They've just called it advection, this little thing here. But in fact, it's a very much more complicated process. All sorts of things go on in the ocean. As I said, the wind causes currents of various sorts. There's interactions with topography. And there's a whole range of wave-like features inside the ocean that contribute to various shear flow and turbulent structures. And that's not accounted for explicitly in climate models because it occurs on much smaller scales than is possible. And so we have to be able to estimate how much mixing takes place given sort of more broad measures of the strength of the flow and the strength of the stratification. And here's just another example. We're about to enter an El Nino year, having been in a La Nina year, which is when the water in the equatorial Pacific heats up on the western side and causes dramatic changes to the weather. So we're expecting a kind of interesting year ahead, I think, in terms of extreme weather. And this is caused by flow driven by the trade winds generating flow beneath the surface and causing the water on the eastern side of the Pacific to warm up. And what you can see from here that we see a very complicated current structure. So going towards the west, some depth above that going to the east, so in opposite directions, so a shear flow like this. And one of the questions you want to ask is, how much mixing does this cause? How much of this warm water does this bring down into this region and so on? So it's very important from those purposes. And what we also see if we look in the ocean is interesting structures. So this is these are pictures from acoustic backscatter, but they give some idea of the sort of density structure in the ocean. And this is a shear flow, so there's a flow to the left at the bottom and a shear flow to the right at the top. So again, this, this flow in opposite directions causing these interesting instabilities and mixing processes. So what I want to address today is some questions. So what form, for example, does mixing take place in the stratified shear flow? Can we predict the rates, given that we know the velocity and density fields? How do these depend on the fluid properties? In the ocean, we have both temperature variations and variations in salinity. Does that matter? And one of the things that we're really interested in, how is the energy transferred from the wind or from the current into the density field, which is a potential energy process, essentially. Okay, so this is the canonical picture. So this is a stratified shear flow. So we imagine that we have a velocity field which changes with depth, say by an amount delta U. And we have a density field, which I've denoted by buoyancy B. So B is the buoyancy, so it's more buoyant at the top. Delta V is positive, right? So that's effectively a density stratification where the densest fluid's at the bottom and the lighter fluid's at the top, which is the natural configuration always. And from these things, you can construct a dimensionless parameter which tells you about the stability of the system. It's called the Richardson number, after L.F. Richardson, famous meteorologist, fellow of King's. You can from these parameters, you can get this dimensionless quantity. So B, buoyancy, has dimensions of gravity, which has dimensions of acceleration. U has dimensions of velocity. So the dimensions of this quantity are length. This is acceleration, length over time squared, and this is velocity squared, and they cancel out, of course. So it's dimensionless. It's just a number, and it tells you about the stability of the system. And you can see that in the following way. So if we take a little parcel of fluid at the bottom here, and we raise it to the top, the change in potential energy is essentially G rho H, which is essentially H delta B. And the change in kinetic energy is just the difference in velocity, so delta U squared. So that's the same as before, right? So this parameter is really a ratio of the potential energy of that motion compared to the kinetic energy. And if you're going to do it, you've got to have more kinetic energy than the potential energy you need. So this has to be less than one, right, for that to happen. And if you look in the ocean, you find that actually the number is about at 10 or bigger, okay? So this is an interesting question. How does this actually happen, given that it doesn't seem to be energetically possible? And I'll come back to that at the end. Okay, so I'm going to talk about this experiment that we've been running in Dampt for about 10 years, I guess. It's a very simple experiment. We take two reservoirs, one on the left with dense fluid, one on the right with less dense fluid, and we join them with a duct. It's just a tube. It's actually a square tube. And we simply tilt the duct at some small angle, theta, to the horizontal. And so essentially what happens is the heavy fluid runs downhill and the light fluid runs uphill, and we generate this counterflow. And it's stably stratified because the heavy stuff in white is below the less dense stuff above, which is colored. Okay, so a very simple experiment, and it runs as long as the reservoirs run, essentially. And this is what it actually looks like in the version I'm mainly going to talk about. So we have this duct joining these two reservoirs. One's got dense fluid, one's got less dense fluid, and we tilt it and open the tube and let the flow go from one to the other. And what that looks like is as follows. So you start off at the beginning with all the dense fluid on the left. I've changed the color scheme just to keep you alert. All the dense fluid on the left, all the light fluid on the right. There's this exchange flow for a long time. And then at the end, of course, all the dense fluid ends up on the bottom and all the light fluid ends up on the top. And if there's no mixing, there's no change in density. That's just what happens. Very straightforward. And so what you can talk about this in terms of energy. So initially, all the energy is potential because nothing's moving. You open the duct, the flow accelerates, there's a kinetic energy. And as the fluid changes from one reservoir to the other, the potential energy decreases. And eventually, there's no potential energy left on the right. The flow stops and all the energy is now in the internal energy of the system. Okay, so that's very straightforward. And what we're interested in is this period in the middle when there is essentially a constant flow in time with constant kinetic energy, and the potential energy slowly drains as the reservoir exchange fluid from one to the other. So we want to focus on that so-called temporary steady state. And we're interested in this conversion from the potential energy into the kinetic energy and then dissipation through viscous forces into internal energy and also some mixing. So I've drawn the situation without any mixing, but in practice there's mixing. And we want to know, one of the big questions, and I'll come back to that, is what's the ratio between the mixing and the dissipation? Okay. All right.
I'm not sure I understand.
That's all right, Siri. Okay. So so the mathematics of the system, of course, it's governed by the Navier-Stokes equations, continuity and equation for the conservation of mass. And we can do some non-dimensionalization. And we have four dimensionless parameters for a given set of geometry. Okay, so we have the standard ones, which is the Reynolds number based on the velocity difference and the depth. We have a Richardson number, which is a measure of the stratification. We have the angle that we tilt the duct. And we have the Prandtl number, which is the ratio of the molecular diffusivity of momentum nu or the kinematic viscosity to the diffusion ratio of the diffusion rate of of whatever's producing the density. And I'm mainly going to talk about experiments with solutes. So this number is about 700. Okay. But I'll come back to that as well. So let's first of all look at see how our experiment compares with nature. So what I've done here is looked at the three parameters, the four parameters. So the Reynolds number at the top. So you can see that we sit somewhat around 1,000 or maybe 10,000. In nature, we're quite a lot larger. The Richardson number is always around below one, which is sort of straddle where we are with nature. I'm going to talk about experiments where the Prandtl number is 700 with salt, but I'll also talk about some with temperature where it's seven. And we're going to talk about angles theta. And so, for example, if we compare it with an outflow from a river, we're quite a bit lower than Reynolds numbers, which are several million in that circumstance. You could also compare it with the, as I said, this current in the equatorial current. Here, the Reynolds number is even higher, maybe 10 to the ninth. So we're kind of well below nature in Reynolds number. Maybe that's an issue. What we are not doing is we're having small angles, so we're only working very close to the horizontal, so we're not worried about things like plumes and thermals, and we're certainly not doing things which are unstable like convection, and we're ignoring lots of other interesting things that go on in the ocean like tides, solar radiation, rain, internal waves, and things like that. Okay, so I've been through that. And just to make a point is that this is the system, actually. We have fresh water coming in and mixing. By fresh, I mean from the reservoir, a counterflow in the opposite direction. The boundary conditions are no slip on the velocity on top and bottom and on the sides, no flux of density, top and bottom and on the sides, and this non-periodic inflow of fresh fluid and outflow of mixed fluid. So it makes, and I'm going to talk about DNS, makes computation very difficult. Okay, so what do we know about this? Well, the first thing we discovered was that the flow is hydraulically controlled. So that what we did was to essentially set the experiment up. We measured, had the initial density. We ran it for a time. We then mixed everything up again, and we worked out what the transfer of mass was from one side to the other. And from that, you can work out what the exchange flow is from one side to the other. So there's no net flow, so no net volume flow, but there's an exchange flow of one to the other. And if you plot that in as a function of either the tilting the angle, either increasing the tilt, or the Reynolds number, which you change by changing the density difference, you find that it increases up to some limit and then it doesn't get any further. Okay, so the velocity scales like the square root of the buoyancy times h. Remember, buoyancy has dimensions of acceleration. So that's acceleration times length, that's velocity squared. So this dimensionless flow rate, q, is fixed at some maximum value. I believe this is a test because I saw the sign. Okay. right? So that's the first thing. So that means that you can't increase the mean flow through the system above this value, okay? And that's a very important part of this flow. It's actually what makes the experiment really interesting, is because when I take the experiment and I tilt my duct more, I have a component of gravity going down, down along the length of the duct. That puts energy into the system. The more I tilt it, the more energy I put in, but I can't go any faster than this. So the mean flow doesn't go any faster. So the mean energy doesn't increase. So how do you get rid of the rest of the energy? Okay. And that's what makes it interesting. And that's what we observe. So what we find when we do this experiment is, in fact, that we get four flow regimes for the different parameters. And essentially, you can think of this as just increasing the angle or increasing the Reynolds number, the density difference. So we start off with essentially a laminar flow, and you can see there's no disturbance of the interface. You can't really see anything interesting happening. When we force it a bit harder, we get waves. And these are sharp cusp waves discovered by Hombo, hence called Hombo waves. We then find a regime where the flow becomes intermittently turbulent. So it sort of goes through a calm period like now, and then a more vigorous period. And that repeats itself many times, as you can see. And then we have a period when this is just turbulent all the time. Okay. And if we plot that on a sort of Reynolds number theta graph, you can see that for low Reynolds numbers and low angles, we're in this laminar state. And as we either increase the Reynolds number or the angle, we go through the Hombo state, the intermittent state, and the turbulent state. So as we put more and more energy into the system, we have to, as I said, the flow can't go any faster than that limit. So we have to dissipate it internally. And so it does it. This is more dissipated than this. This is more dissipated than that. And this is more dissipated again, right? So what you're seeing is the system adjusting to the forcing in this way. I thought we'd discovered all of this, and then I read the literature and discovered that it'd been done in 1961 by two famous engineers, Hunter Rouse, in the States. And they did a kind of experiment that was almost identical to ours, and they discovered all the four regimes I've just been talking about. But that's about all they did. So. But it was a salutary lesson. You should read the literature. Okay, so we can plot our experiments. So we've made visualizations of those four regimes, and we can plot them on Reynolds number theta plot. And I just did it schematically. This is log. Green is laminar. Blue is laminar. Green is waves. Yellow is intermittent, and red is turbulent. And we discovered that the transitions here appear to occur where the theta times the Reynolds number is a constant. So this is a kind of an energy input into the system, either increasing theta or increasing the Reynolds number increases that. And we see this transition from one to the other. And I'll talk a bit more about how that happens. Okay, so that's all sort of looking at the global picture. And now I want to look in some detail at flow. So what we do is we've set up a system where we do PIV and planar laser-induced fluorescence simultaneously to get the velocity and density field. So we take a small section and we look at it with three cameras. Two cameras look stereoscopically at a vertical laser sheet, and that gives us PIV particles, that gives us the three components of velocity in that plane. And then we have a central camera that looks at fluorescent dye. So it gives us the density field. And then, so that's what it looks like here. So we have this laser underneath the system, giving us a vertical plane. These two cameras get the velocity field. This one gets the density field. And then from the side, here is our plane. We then scan this back and forth and get a whole series of planes. So we get all three components of velocity and density in a volume. Okay. So it gives us really excellent statistics. We're able to measure the full velocity density field in X, Y, Z and time with well, that sort of resolution. Essentially, for those of you who are interested in turbulence, we get down to the Kolmogorov scale for Reynolds numbers of about just under 1,000, roughly. But a long way from the Batchelor scale, if that means anything. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some particular data sets later on. Okay, so this is the kind of thing you see. So this is a turbulent case, a Reynolds number of 1,200, quite a steep angle, 6 degrees. Up at the top is the density field. So this is a turbulent case. You can see the mixing process. This is the streamwise velocity, the spanwise velocity, vertical velocity, and the spanwise vorticity on a vertical plane. So we get you can see very complicated three-dimensional structures in this turbulent situation. And we spent quite a lot of time looking at the details of those. I don't have time to talk about those today. And you can do the same thing on a horizontal plane. So again, you can see the density field. So if you look at the density field, there's again lots of three-dimensional structure in this horizontal plane. And again, you can see streamwise, spanwise, and vertical velocity. And from this, we can extract structures and so forth. Okay. So one of the big issues that we worry about in turbulence is what's called mixing efficiency. And I like to think of this as the bath problem. So imagine that you're sitting in the bath at the top picture. So it's a mathematician's bath, okay? It gets cold, so you put some more water in. And because the water's hot, it floats on the surface. So we have this red layer of warm water sitting at the top of your bath, okay? And you think this is very uncomfortable. So you put your hand in, and you swirl it around, and eventually the temperature's uniform everywhere, okay? All right, and so what happens to that is if you look at the density field on the top picture, it's less dense at the bottom and the center of mass is somewhere. And when you mix it all up, the average density is less than the original density and the center of mass goes up, right? So the work you do, some of the work you do raises the center of mass of the system, okay? So that's kind of the energy that's going into the potential energy, right? And the work you've done is how much kinetic energy you put in. And we want to know the ratio of that. That's a really important ingredient because we know how much energy we've got in our system, but how much do we generate from mixing, okay? And the way you do that is to figure out this energy input to raise the center of mass, it's actually to do with molecular mixing of the density field. And it's actually given by the diffusivity times the gradient of the buoyancy field. So this happens at really tiny scales, okay? And the energy that you put in the rest is dissipated viscously with epsilon. And so the efficiency is the ratio of those two quantities, okay? And so with our velocity measurements, we can begin to measure those things. So as I said, we're interested in this process, and we had this diagram before. So we have viscous dissipation going into internal energy, and we have irreversible mixing, that chi quantity from the previous graph, which is to do with actually diffusion processes. And we want to know this ratio, this mixing efficiency. Okay, so I'm going to do the energetics now. And we're going to draw a box around our system. So we have the reservoirs outside. And then we force the system by tilting the duct and changing the Reynolds number. And if you calculate it, as I said, things scale like the product of theta times Re, and it happens to be 0.04 times theta Re. That's the energy you put in. It goes initially into the kinetic energy, and some of it goes into the buoyancy field through mixing to dissipation and some viscous dissipation. If I increase the energy input, so tilt the duct more, I get some mean kinetic energy, more mean kinetic energy. And if I do it even further, I get now both, so the mean kinetic energy is dissipated viscously through the mean gradients. I also, once that reaches the limit, when you get to the hydraulic control and the mean velocity is going as fast as it can, then we have to do something else. So we produce waves or we produce turbulence. So now we get turbulent production, and that turbulent production is viscously dissipated through this term epsilon. And we get some of the turbulence causes mixing, changes the potential energy, and that mixing gives you the irreversible amount. Okay, and so again, we can then look at these quantities. So we have production of turbulent kinetic energy P goes into the buoyancy flux and dissipation through epsilon. And the buoyancy flux essentially doesn't get stored in the potential energy, but goes through this mixing process through diffusion chi. And we are interested in that ratio. Okay, and so we're interested in these key ratios. This mixing efficiency, chi over epsilon, which is effectively the buoyancy flux over epsilon. And for people who are really working this subject, there's another Richardson number called the flux Richardson number, which is the buoyancy flux over production. And we care about those numbers. Okay, and this is what we find in our experiments that are turbulent. So the mixing efficiency we find, so the cases linked called I are the intermittent cases where it's sometimes turbulent, and the red ones are the turbulent cases. We find mixing efficiencies of about 10%, 0.1. So most of the work you do in your bath, you're just stirring it around and wasting it. It's just going to viscous dissipation. Only a 10% of it, roughly, we think, goes into changing the stratification and making it feel more comfortable. Okay. Oceanographers use a number which is 0.2 for long historical reasons. And it may be that our Reynolds number is not high enough. That's possible. So maybe if we push our Reynolds number up, it'll go up. But this is what we get for our particular situation. Okay. Okay, I just want to just show you one other thing you can get out of this kind of analysis. As I said before, this transition from these different regimes goes like theta Reynolds number equals constant. And we can, so that's on this plot of log theta and log Reynolds number, it's just a straight line like that. We can, from these kind of measurements, we can look at what's called entropy, which is the square of the vorticity. And we can look at situations where the vorticity is large. That means the flow is being strongly strained in the turbulent process. And if we plot that on this plot and do the calculation from the data, we find that also scales like theta RE. Okay. We can also look at the fraction of the fluid that's actually overturned. In other words, when the process mixes, puts heavy fluid on top of light fluid. Okay. So we can look at the overturn fraction, which, of course, if heavy fluid on top of light fluid is unstable, so it would cause mixing. And we find that doesn't scale in the same way. It scales differently with theta and Reynolds number. So this is interesting because if I go down this line, I'm staying in the same regime. And what I'm doing here is I'm going from high tilts and low Reynolds, relatively low Reynolds numbers, to low tilts and high Reynolds number. And of course, what this means is, since this is above this line here, which is the overturning line, it means that at high angles, I'm getting lots of overturning relative to the straining. But at low angles down here and at high Reynolds numbers, I get much more straining than I get overturning, even though the flow is in the same flow regime because it's on this same line. So we see a different character of the turbulence depending on how we force it. And that has some implications for structure and so on. Okay. All right. So I've been talking about experiments. We have recently been involved with DNS of this problem. And I'd like to spend a bit of time talking about that. So this is the experiments. We now have a much more sophisticated experiment than the one I showed you, with bigger reservoirs, different. This is the duct in between two reservoirs. We can lift this up mechanically and control it. So we can do it in variant in time. the fact that duct is now in air gives us much better optical access, and we have much higher resolution for our data. And what we can find with lab experiments is that we can adjust the parameters quite well. We have real boundary conditions because you can't avoid them. The diagnostics is quite difficult. The spatial resolution accuracy of the data is not bad. And we can do very long time series. These reservoirs will run so that we have 1,000 objective time units, runs for a long time. If we go to DNS, the changing the parameters is quite moderately difficult because it's expensive in computing time. Standard way of doing things is to have periodic boundary conditions in, for example, the streamwise and the spanwise direction, which are not appropriate for this rig. Diagnostics is very good, good resolution typically, and long run times are hard because of storage issues and so on. So there are strengths and weaknesses of both of these, and we like to combine them and try and see what we can get out of both. So I'm going to show you now the results of some recent DNS that we've been carrying out. This uses a 3D solver, X Compact 3D, and it deals with the geometry exactly as it is in the experiment. So we solve the same equations, the continuity, momentum, and mass, as I described before. We're going to talk about thermal stratification now. So all the things I've told you up until now have been salt stratification, Prandtl number 700, thermal stratification in water, Prandtl number is 7. So a factor of 100 different. Reynolds numbers of the order of 100, angles between 0 and 10 degrees. This is what you see from the DNS. So you see very similar features as we saw in the experiment. And we have in this system reservoirs here where we damp the flow and restore the density back to its original value. So in practice, this can run for as long as you can compute it, right? And that's done through these two terms on the right, FV and F rho, which are essentially like a sponge layer. Think of them like a sponge layer. The fluid comes in, it's decelerated, the density is transformed, and then it's fed back in here. And there's quite a lot of fiddling around to make that work, but it works, okay? And so you can see, and this is the density field, and this is the velocity field in that configuration. So I think this is the first time I've been doing experiments since 1969, and this is the first time I've ever had a DNS which is identical to an experiment. Same boundary conditions, same geometry, same fluid, no fudges, amazing. Had to wait a long time. And we can compare it with our experiments. So we see the same flow regimes. We see a laminar flow. We see waves in the middle. We see an intermittent turbulent case and the fully turbulent case. And we can compare the regime diagram for experiments, which are the little dots, Reynolds and theta. And the big symbols are DNS runs. And what you're supposed to see is that the colors match. So we find the same flow regimes and the same parameters, thank goodness, as we see in experiments. Okay, and these are not new experiments. We did a whole bunch of experiments with temperature. So it is temperature and water. Okay, so that's really reassuring. We believe that the DNS captures what we do accurately. And we can see, for example, here, this shows a comparison of a shadowgraph image on the top right. So this is with temperature stratification. This is in the wave regime. The DNS We extract the density field and construct an artificial shadowgraph from the DNS. And you can see very nice agreement, I think, between the structures we see in the experiment and in the intermittent case, again, we see very similar features between the experiment and the DNS. And for example, we also see in the intermittent case, spatial. So this is a time space plot of the density field. You can see here at this angle of theta 3 degrees, we get these intermittent bursts in the DNS and the experiment with the same time scale. And we go to 5 degrees, and again, we see good correspondence. So I think everything shows that these agree very nicely. So what can we get out of the DNS that we couldn't get out of the experiments? Okay, so I'm going to show you a couple of things. So first of all, it allows us to see along the whole length of the duct. As I showed you, we're only able to look at a small part from our experiment. So we're able to look at the whole thing. So if we plot, so this is the kinetic energy. So we can see that this is X and time. So this is from one end of the duct to the other. This is time. For the lamina case, nothing happens. Bit of kinetic energy at the ends. In the wave case, we see some structure. And then we see in the intermittent case, the intermittency is not just in time, which would be following at fixed X, but it's also at fixed time in X. So it's spatially intermittent as well as temporally intermittent. And we see this from the time series as well. So we can see these long time series. So we saw that in the experiment from qualitative pictures, but we couldn't measure it along the whole length. The other thing I told you about was the idea that the flow rate through the system is limited by this hydraulic control. The mean flow can't go any faster. So the experiments show this is this value Q, which limits at 0.5. And so these are experimental data for temperature. And this is the DNS showing again the same limit. And the question now is, what's going on in this limit? How do these hydraulic controls really work? And what you can get from DNS that you can't get from experiments is the pressure field. Okay, so here is the pressure field plotted. So blue is low pressure, red is high pressure. And if you look at the laminar flow, so the one at the top, you can see the bottom layer has high pressure on the left and low pressure on the right. So there's a favorable pressure gradient all the way along, pushing the bottom layer to the right. And if you look at the upper layer, it's a high pressure on the right, low pressure on the left. So a pressure gradient in this direction, pushing the upper layer in the opposite direction, just as you expect.
Sorry, I'm still not sure about that.
So if you go to either the wave or the intermittent case, you see the pressure field is quite different, right? Now we go from high pressure to low pressure in the same layer and then back to high pressure. So this layer has a positive or prograde pressure gradient and then an adverse pressure gradient in the second half, right? So the flow is coming in, it's being accelerated in by this pressure gradient,
I'm still not sure
but about that. But then it reaches some critical amount and then it's decelerated by the pressure field, okay? And what this means is that the hydraulic control is changing position. So in the laminar case, it's just as it leaves the reservoir, at least the duct and enters the reservoir. Here, we're beginning to see jumps in hydraulic control in the center of the duct. So a completely different mechanism happening here, which we just speculated from our observations and experiments, but we couldn't verify it. So you can really see a big difference.
Is that the instantaneous pressure field?
Pardon?
Is that the instantaneous?
Yep. That's a good question. I think it's just a snapshot. I think it may have been I think these are just snapshots. Yeah. Yeah. With all of these little features like that, it's just a particular snapshot. But I think the time averages is very similar, actually. And again, so you can see now that we can look, for example, at the layer height or the velocity. We see in the laminar case, the jumps occur just as the fluid enters the reservoir. Now we begin to see jumps in the interior of the system. And it raises a whole range of interesting questions I don't have time to go into. But fascinating. I want to finish by just saying a little bit about coming back to this question about how do you mix in systems where the Richardson number is very high, stable. And this goes back to my PhD supervisor, who wrote a very influential book in fact while I was doing my PhD. Stuart Turner, and he said, well, one way of getting around this dilemma is instead of having a uniform gradient in density from top to bottom and velocity from top to bottom, you can have regions where the density is essentially uniform and then a big jump and then another uniform layer. And then the local Richardson number as a function of Z everywhere can be as small as you like, essentially because this is a square rather than a linear power. So you, if you make this interface thin enough, you can always make this number as small as you want, right? And so his argument is that actually what you find is not just a uniform density field, but regions where the interface, where there are layers of essentially no density gradient, and then interfaces. And so we've started to look at what happens in our experiments. So we've got velocity and density profiles here from various situations, and I'll simply concentrate on these turbulent cases. And you can see that we generate this kind of mixed region in the middle with an interface at the top and the bottom, similarly here. And if we calculate the if I calculate now the gradient Richardson number, this value, which is a function of Z, it's essentially the same parameter, but now local. So what we find is our mixing region has a region in the center, which is relatively well mixed with interfaces at the top and bottom. So these two interfaces, we can calculate the gradient Richardson number. So it's just determined by the thickness of that interface, the density jump across it, and the shear jump across it. And I can rearrange that in terms of this overall value times delta over H. And in an experiment, this is always a quarter because the flow is constrained by the velocity field. And so since that's a quarter, that always, this number comes out to be the thickness of the interface divided by twice the height of the system. Okay, so come back to that. So now if we look at these values for the gradient Richardson number, for the turbulent cases, these ones down here, we find that it's fairly uniform in this region around somewhere between 0.1 and 0.2. And we can do the PDF, and we find that as the flow becomes more turbulent, we get this sort of self-organization of the flow with a Richardson number of somewhere between 0.1 and 0.2. And if we go and measure what happens at our little interfaces in our system, we find that the thickness of these interfaces in dimensionless form is somewhere around 0.3. And as I said, this value should be delta over 2H. So if that's 0.3, this value is about 0.15. So we're seeing a sort of consistent picture. No one knows why this is the right number. Okay, so that's an interesting problem. We don't know why that's a good number, except it has to be quite small. And we know it has to be less than a quarter. So, okay, so that brings me almost to the end. So I said I had these four questions. So I've tried to give you some flavor of an answer. So the answers, I think, are that the form depends on the energy of the flow. We've looked at the mixing efficiency. It's about 10% in our experiments. We also see different flow structures. They were different for the temperature field and the salinity field. But what happens in the ocean where there's both together, we don't know. The production of turbulent kinetic energy leads to mixing through both straining and overturns. It depends. And I showed you situations where you could get the same process. And of course, I didn't do all this anywhere near by myself. This project's been going on for a long time. In particular, staff members in Damp, Colin Caulfield, Stuart Diel, Rich Kurzweil, and John Taylor have been involved in projects with me on this. My current team, who have been doing the most latest stuff, are Sanyang Zhang, Alpan Kong, Amir Atufi, Adrian Lefauve, and Lu Zhu. All the credit should really go to these guys. They do all the hard work. I just come and present. Okay, so thank you very much.
We're going to open the floor for questions. If you're going to ask a question, can I ask you to speak into this because we're recording the call? Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
Is there a straightforward explanation for why the flow is hydraulically controlled? What is it stops the velocity just going up, increasing ad infinitum?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. It's unstable to long waves, essentially. So once the shear gets to a certain level, it becomes unstable to long waves. That instability essentially leads to a breakdown, leads to the control itself. So really it's a long wave instability. We have been doing an analysis, taking the DNS data and dividing it into two layers, assuming that it's two layers, and analyze it as such, and looking, for example, at the composite Froude number and the characteristics of the system, and you find that the flow goes unstable when you get to Q equals 0.5, actually. I think what's interesting about it is that we always think, I've always thought about hydraulic control as a flow that's constrained by geometry or something, you know, so you go over a sill or you go through a narrowing, and that process, I think, sort of leads to the flow's coming along, it reaches a hill, it starts to get an adverse pressure gradient, and that causes the control. Here we do it just by pushing from both ends. There's no change in the geometry. So I think it's quite an interesting idea that, you know, you're trying to push too hard from both ends at the same time in the system because I can't do this. You know, it's sort of like it runs into this pressure minimum and then starts to get decelerated. And so it's a different mechanism, and it is associated with the instability of the long wave. Yeah.
Thank you. So we have seen the scaling law as the theta times RE, and which is relevant to the mixing. So is there any physical insight we can draw from such the equivalence between these two parameters? So the theta and the Reynolds number has the same power and has the same impact on the mixing rate. So is there any, what we can draw about the physics?
Yeah, I think these are both forcing mechanisms, obviously, right? I probably wasn't completely clear. But the Reynolds number is based on essentially just on the density difference between the two reservoirs. So that sets the velocity scale, and that's the scale that's used in the Reynolds number. Okay, so that velocity scale is again a sort of pressure gradient, and that is one forcing, and then the other forcing is the component of gravity, which is g sine theta. Okay, I think they both contribute to a streamwise pressure gradient in the same way, essentially. So if you look in the momentum equation, for example, you have the pressure gradient balances g sine theta plus a viscous term involving the 1/ the Reynolds number. So if you multiply through, then essentially you get theta RE together. Yeah.
Thank you.